Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by two guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I am Adam Pranica.
I am Benjamin R. Harrison.
Back behind the mics after, what do we got, like 3 weeks in Adam and Ben time. always imperceptible to the viewer at home.
It has been a long time since we've recorded an episode of this show. Why did we even show them behind the curtain?
I think they like seeing behind the curtain.
Oh, yeah?
I think they like seeing underneath the kimono. That's an HR violation in at Uxbridge Shimoda LLC, though. You can't do that.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, we are the HR department, so we can look the other way on this particular instance of it.
We're going to get away with it with just a slap on the wrist.
Yeah. But then, like, years from now, they will find that our company had a culture of kimono looking behind from the beginning. It was, some say, baked into the DNA of the company.
Would that be the Uxbridge side or the Shimoda side of that family?
I think you know which side it is, Adam.
I've never been the baker in my family. If we're talking about baking things in, that was always Rishon's deal. I was the steeper of the tea.
But respecting people's boundaries and personal privacy is not my strong suit. Of course, I famously implanted a music box in Deanna Troi's brain.
I also like to believe that my mass extermination of the Hooshnock counted as just a slight overreach in someone's privacy.
Neither of these are things that I did with explicit consent. I see the error of my ways now. I mean, it was the 90s, it was a different time, but that's not an excuse.
I'm personally just wondering when my rehabilitation tour can begin.
Some nights I drive behind the Comedy Cellar, look out the window at it, and wish to get back to my roots.
Hey, is anyone here from out of town? Specifically, the Hooshnock homeworld? Boy, are my extermination powers tired.
Let's talk about in-flight meals for a second. Specifically, interstellar meals.
Take my rubber wife, please.
Real tight five by Kevin Uxbridge there. Yeah. Not a surprise. He's had a millennium to work on it.
He's doing a lot of material that is severely dated even by our standards, but he can be forgiven given his extreme age.
Be quiet, Grandpa.
Yeah. Adam, I have a big old box here, and it's I actually got it before we left for the most recent leg of our tour, but I'm excited to open it. You want to listen to me open a box?
You should open that box in case there's food inside.
Captain, I'm sorry to disturb you.
I'm receiving a code 47.
Verify.
It is code 47, sir. Starfleet emergency frequency.
Captain's eyes only.
The address is, it leads me to believe this is going to contain comics. I'm opening it, and holy shit, Adam, this contains a shit ton of comics.
Whoa, was it, is the box like one of those coffin comic boxes?
It's like the Priority Mail medium flat rate box. Okay, right on top, I've got a Star Trek The Next Generation 1989 calendar. And it's like a wall calendar, month to month.
Now we got to see when 1989 can be reused, right?
Yeah, we do. These are blown up photos that are not great quality. January is Captain Jean-Luc Picard as Private Detective Dixon Hill. There's Q in his judge getup from Encounter at Farpoint.
In his big hat.
Oh, here's the Traveler. Loxana Troy. No Shimoda. Sad. What else do we got in here? This looks like it's like a coloring book calendar. It's called the Star Trek The Next Hysterical Calendar. And on the cover is Worf with like a suction cup dart stuck to his loaf. And a kick me sign taped to his back. And
you said this calendar was from 1988?
Yeah.
Wow, check it out. So you can't use an 88 calendar until 2044.
Shit, Doug.
And then after that, 2072. That calendar, Ben, I'm sorry to tell you, almost worthless.
There's a... the March image is the original series Enterprise with the Millennium Falcon like hiding under the disc. Like you know when when they like park it on the back of the Star Destroyer and then float away with the garbage. It seems like a lot of the humor from this is based on the idea of Star Trek and Star Wars meeting up.
Feels like some real science fiction carpetbagging, if you ask me.
I cannot believe this exists.
That's what people say about our show.
Yeah.
You can't reuse this episode until 2044 also.
Yeah. I've got several copies of Star Trek The Next Generation magazine, an issue of Cinetastique, all about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, as well as an issue of Starlog magazine about Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Koch Comics really understands value because you want to go for that flat rate box if you're stuffing it full of old magazines and calendars.
Oh, here's a letter, I think. Oh, man. Letter is full of collectible card game cards. See, here's what it says. Dear Benjamin, the work you and Adam have done these past few years has kept me falling into the depths of my depression and crapulence. Oh, no. I keep thinking...
Was that word crapulence?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know that word, but... I keep thinking of running away from it all, but the laughter and talk about hygiene and mental health has given me a bit of hope for the future. Enough to clean the schmutz off my face, dust off my pants, and test the world at the beginning and end of every week. In the box are the few Star Trek comic books I could find at work. They go as quickly as we can get them in. And plenty of magazines for your, quote, research, unquote. Most importantly of all is a sealed box from the customizable card game for the series Mirror Mirror. According to the box, each pack holds 11 cards. There are 30 packs, meaning you can spend half a season playing war. Live long and prosper, Dave. Dave, thank you so much.
Always great to hear that we have helped anyone in any way by doing this dumb show. So thanks for
as implausible as it is.
Yeah, speaking of implausibility, Ben, what would you say if I told you that that Quark could be installed as the leader of a Klingon house? Would you be ready to believe that?
I would Elaine Bennis style shove you and say, get out!
Well, we have got the episode for you, Ben, as we talk about Deep Space Nine, Season 3, Episode 3, The House of Quark.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No. Of course you don't.
I love starting an episode on Morn, and I think we're going to get more and more of this.
Yes.
Like, We start on Morn and then move the camera to where the action really is. But the action, I think, is going to be taking place in Morn's quarters because he's ready to lay that hammer down.
Yeah, he gives like a fist pump to Quark and Rom as he leaves the bar with a beautiful lady.
And it's not that Quark and Rom are like upset that that Morn is about to embark on some consensual lovemaking with a lady from the bar. It's that it's a really bad sign when Morn leaves the bar, because Morn is usually the last one to leave, and it's not closing time yet.
Rule of acquisition 286. When Morn leaves, it's all over.
Morn is like one of the last customers they've got, and Quark is feeling really down about business. It seems that the recent excitement surrounding the Founders and the Dominion have really put a chilling effect on Deep Space Nine.
It's not surprising to me that that a scandal like the chance of death could keep people away from what we're to understand is not a really great place to get a drink or a bite to eat.
Yeah.
Like, people prefer the Replimat.
Station traffic in general is way down, but Quark's bar is dead. And the only customer they've got left is a super drunk Klingon.
Yeah, he is like barf on the table drunk.
Yeah.
And he wants another drink, like most barf on the table drunks do, only he's run out of money.
This guy definitely has been overserved and needs to be cut off, but also they don't want to turn away another sale, given how dire the straits are. But yeah, the dude's pockets are full of moths and dust. And he's looking to start a tab on his good reputation, which does not necessarily inspire Quark. I mean, you would think that Quark would be interested in getting into the crediting business, right? He makes so much interest.
That's true. I think the problem is this guy just doesn't look good for it.
Yeah, they don't even like run a background check. You know, they don't give three addresses and say, which of these three have you lived at in the last 5 years, or none of the above. A little Experian material for you.
Ben, they tell you never to fight a drunk. And I think what the scene that we get here is the reason why. This guy is angered at the idea of not having credit extended to him.
Yeah.
And even someone as feeble and as fight averse as Quark is able to somehow trip this guy up to the degree that he falls on his own knife.
Yeah.
And he dead.
And just to confirm that, Quark reaches down and gets a big smear of blood all over his hand so that he can look at it. Yep. Can confirm that is blood.
I don't think you want to touch the blood, do you? Like at a crime scene?
Very strange choice. The only way I would forgive that choice if he'd been like, it's red. What? Wait, is it purple or red? Which is it? Which is it?
Quark and Rom like yell at each other into the show open.
Star Trek in general has Klingon continuity is totally screwed, you know? I think we just have to let it go.
After the break, there's an investigation going on. Like, the body isn't even cold yet.
When there's like a really bad accident on the highway, they like pull a fire truck in front of what's happened so that people don't see the dead bodies or whatever. They do not do that here. They have left all the windows to the bar open to the promenade, and a big crowd has gathered to just gawk at this dude.
This crowd is all a titter about this, and Quark sees this as an opportunity to make some money by turning the situation into legend.
Yeah. In responding to Odo's inquiries about what happened, he kind of projects to the back of the room, and he's answering the question as
much... He does that performative talking?
Yeah. He's answering the question as much for Odo as for all the people assembled, because you know, if he's Quark the Klingon killer, he thinks that people will want to come drink in his bar. If you get too drunk, he might kill you. It's gonna be great for business.
Who wouldn't want to be killed by a Ferengi? In saying that's kind of the core of the episode. That's the core problem,
right?
The degree to which people do not want to be killed by a Ferengi.
Yeah, and they come at that from a lot of different angles.
Ben, there's a different kind of death happening in the quarters of Keiko and O'Brien.
I am Chief Miles Edward O'Brien. This is fucking spectacular.
The death of ambition seems to be all over Keiko's face as she snips some bonsai trees dispassionately at home.
This is a great split diopter shot. She, you know, she's working on the tree and she's kind of by herself, and then O'Brien walks in and orders a beer from the replicator, and he is very deep in the background and she's very nicely framed in the foreground.
I thought it was split diopter too, but I kind of think it's a comp.
Ew.
And here's why. Keiko looks matted, and I've never used a split diopter, so I don't know if you can like rotate it back into square.
Uh-huh.
Is that something that you can do with that kind of lens? Because when O'Brien walks into the foreground on her same focal plane, both of them are in focus, and I don't know how you do that with that kind of lens.
I mean, he's so far back in the room that I think you could have that much depth of focus with that lens. It also might just be that they're shooting on film and they know that what looks focused when they compress it down to standard definition is different from what it would look like if you were, you know, projecting it or transferring it to HD. I don't know. You might be right. If it is a comp, it's probably motion tracked, right? Because the camera moves. It tilts up.
It is so unique in this show. Like this sequence and this shot, I rewound it a couple of times trying to figure out how they did it, because I was just unwilling to believe that it was split diopter given the walk to foreground. That seemed like something they never do.
You might be right that it's a matte. I'm looking at her ear and I'm not sure I believe the edge of it now.
That's exactly what that supports my argument, is her matte ear.
So she's probably on a green screen or something.
That's what I'm guessing.
Wow.
And then they do a nice bit of cutting around it, like because they cut to over O'Brien's shoulder, and then when they cut back to that original shot, they're using a standard lens.
Right.
Or they're both in the same frame.
I don't know why you would do a comp for that shot.
Yeah, it's so much work for that shot, right? But I kind of, like, I really admire it if that's what they did.
Yeah, that's a mystery. I wonder if we had, you know, pulled an nth degree card on this episode, if we would have found out the secret behind it.
What are you doing now? Exactly.
Yeah, so we have kind of two very independent stories in this episode, the Quark killed a Klingon story, and the Miles and Keiko are dealing with the fact that Keiko's school has shut down story, and they don't really overlap or intersect that much. It's an episode of the week. We are not in arc mode at this point.
A lot of what's happened to Keiko has happened off screen. Slowly but surely, like, her school has died because no one is going there anymore. The Bajorans on the station have started going to school on Bajor, leaving only Jake and Nog as the students. And if you're a teacher, that's not going to do it for you. She's decided to pivot into tutoring.
Can you imagine just Keiko, Jake, and Nog in a room together for 8 hours a day? They would drive each other nuts.
That's a real, like, boy meets world situation, right? I would watch that show.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Maybe that's one of the shows they should do with all these new CBS All Access Star Trek shows that they're trying to make.
The Boy Meets World style DS9 universe show with Keiko as Mr. Feeny.
Yep.
That sounds awesome. Who's Topanga in this scenario? Is that Jake or Nog?
I think that Topanga has got to be a Dabo girl.
Yeah, okay.
But also, she's vastly smarter than both of them put together.
Nog is obviously Sean, and Jake is obviously Corey.
Yeah. What's the dweeby kid? Is it Minkus?
Yeah, you're right.
Hell yeah.
Good grab. Really good grab. I'm going to Jackie and Lori show you a picture of Minkus.
Present day Minkus?
Just
Minkus is all grown up, and you won't believe what he looks like.
Oh boy, he kind of grew up into a real boy band type, I think.
He's got that look. I mean, like as a little kid, he's got a cleft in his chin. Like he looks like he's gonna grow up to be a hunk.
God, all I wanted in the world was a cleft chin and pubes. If I had to pick one, I'd probably pick the chin.
Nobody really told me about pubes.
No one tells you about pubes, Ben. You have to find out on your own.
Yeah. I never wanted them. When I started getting them, I'm like, ugh, what's this? No.
And from then on, you made a decision. You'd never have them.
Yep. That's why I'm sponsored by Gillette. I like this O'Brien and Keiko storyline. I mean, the fact that she is upset and feeling adrift is something that he really sympathizes with. And like his arc is, how do I, you know, I'm the reason my wife and I are here on this station. And the, you know, the situation on the station has changed such that she is miserable. And I want to do what I can to remedy that.
To even have an element of a Star Trek story involve like a committed relationship and some of the realistic problems in something like that.
Yeah, these are real marriage feelings.
And the way that they treat this relationship within this episode, I think, is so mature and confident and relatable. That feeling of knowing that your special person is struggling and not really knowing how to help,
yeah,
is such an awful, powerless feeling. And I think Colm Meaney's performance here is great, and so is Rosalind Chow's.
Like, yeah.
They both act the shit out of this episode.
It really comes out of left field that they're going to have a great episode here, because that is not really how it reads at the beginning. And then halfway through, I was like, holy shit, this is actually turning out to be like a pretty amazing O'Brien and Keiko episode.
The way Keiko says I'm fine really is pretty brutal, I think, for anyone who's ever heard I'm fine really in a moment like that.
But I think
it
like,
feels very real.
If you're in a relationship with somebody for any amount of time, this inevitably happens where one person is unhappy and the other person has to puzzle through, is this something that like, is there like a way I can be helping find a solution to the problem, or is this just a, I need to be, you know, here and sympathetic to this right now, and like, or some mix of the two? Like,
that's what I'm fine really does. Like, it never, I'm fine really never stops the problem or like, or makes anything better. I'm fine really begins a process for the other person.
Yeah. It's interesting that it's set against the high drama of Quark playing Klingon.
Yeah.
The tone swings so wildly back and forth in this, but somehow I feel like it kind of held together as an episode. I don't know why.
Yeah, the tone is pendulous, Ben. Back in the bar, business is great. People are coming in wanting to meet the killer of Klingons and have a drink poured by the real-life Quark.
It was a furious exchange of blows.
Even though the blood stain hasn't even been sufficiently cleaned from the middle of the bar.
So the Klingon that he killed was went by Kozak. And Quark meets Dagur, who is Kozak's very angry and aggrieved brother, who wants to know exactly how this went down. And there's a lot of instructing the viewer how Klingons work that I thought was pretty well done, because if you've watched every episode of TNG and Deep Space Nine up to this point, none of this is new to you, but it doesn't come across as a retread, because Quark wouldn't have any context for any of this stuff. So when he starts by saying like,
he just fell,
and Dagur is like,
I'm going to kill you.
And then he has to walk it back and say like,
he fought a brave and valiant battle right up to the end. It was an honor to kill him.
That tells you a lot about what Dagur wants his brother's death to have meant.
And Quark's actions here seem very relatable. Like, he's saying whatever he can to avoid death at this guy's hands.
Right. And that's a theme that really runs throughout this episode. Every time Quark thinks he's kind of figured out how to talk to a Klingon, there's a new layer that is peeled back and reveals that he really doesn't have a great deep understanding of the Klingon conception of honor.
He needs a like straight talk for teens style mentorship about how to have these conversations. And you know who would be great at that is Dax.
Dax would be awesome at that. She gets nothing to do in this episode.
No, not at all.
She and Kira and Sisko are barely in the episode.
This whole situation's complicated because if it's an accident, it means a dishonorable death. If you're killed by a Ferengi, it is also dishonorable. But I guess if you're killed by a Ferengi in combat, it's not totally dishonorable, and there may in fact be honor in that death.
It's a real puzzle.
It's a death riddle wrapped in a death enigma.
O'Brien's first tack for trying to cheer Keiko up is romantic dinner.
The canapes aren't ready yet.
He pops some champagne. They knock boots a little bit. He's making her canapes.
Amorous O'Brien is one of my favorite O'Briens.
Yeah, always puts on a silk shirt, which was a real 90s move. I mean, it's kind of a throwback in his time period, but in the 90s, right. if you wanted to be an amorous dude, you put on a silk shirt.
When was the last time you wore a silk shirt?
Not since the 90s, Adam.
Everyone did it.
I had a pair of silk boxer shorts in the 90s. I was a kid. What was I doing with those?
Yeah, you and me both, man. I'll tell you what I wasn't doing with those. Showing them to any girls.
Yeah.
They were my secret silk.
Yeah, like, I don't know how I got them, like, what persuaded me that I needed them. I think I had it in mind that if you were going to do some sexy times, you needed some sexy underpants, but that was still a decade away from me.
Silk is way too ambitious of a fabric when you're, like, 15.
Yeah, yeah. And when you're starting to, like, learn how to deal with a smelly body, silk is not the fabric for you. That's really, like, varsity-level fabric for somebody that's totally JV.
Really shows a lot of stains. Impossible to clean.
No. Yeah.
You know what? We're kind of bad-mouthing silk, Ben. We don't want to get big silk on our case.
Every time we bad-mouth some... I got a ton of shit for bad-mouthing wadding toilet paper on this show, so...
We clearly just can't come down on either side of big wad.
Yeah, yeah.
Golden cotton.
The cut.
Golden cotton.
So by the morning after, this amorous moment has lost a little bit of shine because on his way out the door, post-coital O'Brien takes one last look at his lovely wife, and she sort of does that thing that Chekhov does when he has the bug in his ear. Like, as soon as he doesn't think he's being looked at, he kind of dead faces away into, like, the middle distance.
CT Alpha 6 has checked out.
And that's what Keiko does. She kind of slumps on the couch and is clearly still unhappy.
If every time my wife left the house to go to work, I was like, I guess I'll just be here all day and slumped on the couch, that would be a real guilt trip. I don't blame him for feeling bad about this, but I also don't blame her for feeling like, God, what am I going to do? Just sit in this house all day?
I am the type that will most definitely wait for the other person to leave the room before, like, actually emoting something like this. So for Keiko to say that she's fine and then to so clearly not be fine in the presence of her husband, I think she's really hurting and she doesn't quite know how to articulate that. I think Keiko has, before this episode, turned the corner into a fully shaded, sympathetic, good character.
I mean, it's kind of canonical, their relationship, though. They barely knew each other when they got married. So the idea of, like, being vulnerable with each other and like, actually expressing themselves might be kind of new to them.
When people talk about, like, the honeymoon being over...
Right.
I think that's what most people are describing, is like when the vulnerability can creep in.
When you can like say something that is challenging without being worried that it's going to be the end or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this is the episode their relationship needed. Also, around this time, a lady Klingon shows up in Quark's bar.
My name is Grilka.
She's just as freaked out and pissed off as D'Gor, but kind of in the opposite direction.
It was hard to recognize her as a female Klingon without, like, the Lursa and Bator-style décolletage.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that there wasn't a window into underboob in her garment.
She's definitely not from House Cleavage the way they are.
She's kind of foxy. Like, she's foxier than a full-blooded Klingon typically is, right?
She is great.
Yeah.
Like, her stepping onto the screen, she has a great entrance into this show.
Yeah.
And she just maintains that intensity throughout. She's so much fun.
She's a ton of fun. She actually abducts Quark. She hyposprays him in the neck, and when he gets hyposprayed to revive him, he is on Kronos in her house. There's an old man there explaining that he's in the what used to be the house of Kozak. She's Kozak's widow.
This has got to be so scary. Like, waking up on Kronos is like a billion times worse than waking up on a plane to Vegas.
What they cut out of this scene right before they revive him is the guy telling the computer to beam all the poop out of his colon so that he doesn't shit himself when he wakes up. Because that's got to be like a pretty standard thing that happens when you nudge someone awake and be like, hey, you're on Kronos. What?
The very next scene that they show is like the exterior of the Great Hall on Kronos. And I was like, there's no way this is Kronos, right? This is like some other Klingon planet. Sure as shit, it's Kronos.
Yeah.
Like, they made it all the way there.
Crazy. So Kozak was the head of one of the great houses, like a Moog level house, apparently. And his death is a big political problem because D'Gor was an enemy of his. And in confirming that Kozak's death was honorable, D'Gor stands to inherit the land and property.
They're desperate to keep their family's house in order. And they're so desperate that they put a robe on Quark and a robe on Grilka.
Yeah.
And then they make Quark repeat after Tunek.
Mm-hmm.
And a kiss later, they're married.
You are husband and wife.
Congratulations to Quark.
Yeah.
And his new wife, Grilka. Ben, did you like this episode?
I loved it. I loved the Klingon bird of prey with the tin cans strung to the back of it, the just married sign in the back window, warping off into the sunset.
I love Grilka and Quark at the wedding cake, like rubbing frosting all over each other's loaf.
Yeah.
That's fun.
She throws a bouquet of knives. Person that catches it is very dead.
Their first dance to Malorta. Not a dry eye in the house.
Yeah.
Just a real pretty moment. Back on DS9, there's a little bit of a McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Between Kira and Dax and Sisko. And they are just talking about some bullshit that does not matter in this episode because a knock is at the door and it's O'Brien. And he wants to talk to Sisko about personal matters. Personal matters of the type that Dax knows immediately that she should leave, and Kira's like, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to keep doing the work I'm here to do because I'm a professional.
To everyone's credit, O'Brien is like, oh, you guys are working. I'll come back later. And Sisko's like, no, it's cool. What do you want to talk about? And he's like, oh, well, it was a personal matter. So we can talk about it later. It's totally fine. And Dax is like, Kira, let's get out of here. And Kira is very disrespectful.
Must be some kind of human thing.
Kira, like me, is like, Sisko and O'Brien aren't even that close of friends. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? What could this possibly be about that I can't be here for? Do Sisko and O'Brien have this kind of relationship? This seems like an O'Brien to Bashir conversation to be having. And they have another one like that later, but
right.
Like, this seems to be like overstepping a professional subordinate to manager relationship.
Right, because like they're so, like, in terms of rank, couldn't be further from each other, you know? Like, O'Brien has, like, an important job on the station, but he's an enlisted man, and Sisko is an officer in
Starfleet.
Wouldn't
you be reluctant to talk about wife problems with the guy who is a widower? Like, hey, you remember when your dead wife was alive?
How'd you make her happy?
Do you ever think about whether or not she was happy when she was alive?
How do you think? Is she happy now, do you think?
I mean, if she wasn't assimilated, I mean. Do you ever think about that?
Is she assimilated?
I think it's a coin flip as to whether or not she's assimilated, Ben.
Wow.
That's what I think.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Damn.
That's a dark timeline.
Yeah.
So, in spite of how much we question how close O'Brien and Sisko are, this is actually a really great conversation they have. Like, they are exchanging a currency here that feels real and good. And this idea that it is easy for Sisko to do him this favor of granting him a cargo bay for an arboretum.
Well, the station is mostly empty and always has been.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like its a growth curve is exactly great right now. So,
I think Bay 21 would be ideal.
Sisko's like, as long as Keiko doesn't worry about getting knifed by a Jem'Hadar because there's no active security in that part of the station.
Right.
Like, yeah, everything's cool.
Yeah.
Like, Sisko goes down a laundry list of things that are wrong with that cargo bay.
Right. It's also interesting, like, we just witnessed, like, a marriage at knife point, and, like, the idea of that occupying the same space with an episode about a dude just, like, doing everything he can think of to help his wife be happy. It's, like, it's pretty fun.
It is. Very whiplashy.
Yeah.
In tone.
You really want to do this? Here. Now. Okay. Let's do it. Do it.
We get to see Gowron in the central hall or whatever. The Klingon High Council is meeting with D'Gur, who is staking a claim to the assets of House Kozak. And Gowron is like about to rubber stamp this when Grilko walks in and breaks the bad news to everybody.
Enter, husband!
Like, nobody is excited to find out that a Ferengi is going to be leading a great Klingon house.
What is this shit that Gowron's doing? Like, he's overseeing a kind of Klingon people's court here. Like, this seems like real low-rent bullshit for him.
I make claim to the title and property of this fallen house.
You have a canceled check or a paid bill?
I thought he'd have more important things to do. Like, don't get me wrong. I am very thrilled that he's in this episode because I love him as a character. But this seems so beneath him.
It's great house shit. That's what royalty is all about, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I guess so.
I like the.
I love how he struggles to say the word quark.
Quark. Quark.
Ankylosaur.
Like, it really stumbles him.
I like the idea that you can be a different species and lead a Klingon house, though. Like, what if in Discovery, when you saw those, like, hologram Klingon leaders, that, like, one of them just happened to be a Ferengi?
It's fun to get more Klingon world building here because, like, there's so much more to them than just winging batlets around and talking about honor and eating gross food.
Yeah, and how fucking complicated is it that they're, like, cool with a Ferengi dude leading the house, but a Klingon woman leading the house is, like, a big river to cross for them, you know? Like, they're
right.
What the hell
they're
is
more
that?
Okay with a Ferengi as the leader of a house than doing forensic accounting
right.
at any level. Like, that is beneath them.
Turns out D'Gur has been doing some accounting, though. Quark gets Grilka to open the books and let him look at her Klingon spreadsheets. And he finds out that D'Gur has been waging kind of a financial war against the house for a long time, which is why they're getting less powerful. Like, nobody with any honor on Kronos thinks or cares about money, but D'Gur is a real patak, so he's been working on that level the entire time.
You want to find yourself an accountant who's not a patak,
yeah.
If you can.
Yeah.
Quark wants to do some of this forensic accounting for Grilka, and Grilka isn't thrilled about this, but she ultimately demurs.
He's like, let me do it. I brought my accounting vest. Like, I wasn't expecting to get abducted, but look, I got this vest.
He's on Kronos, but he still remains true to his Ferengi roots.
I did love his little PowerPoint presentation where he's trying to talk the Klingons through the forensic accounting wherein he has discovered what a Patak D'Gur really is.
Now, if you go to the file marked devaluation of capital income, we can review the way D'Gur...
That's a great scene.
Yeah. Takes him on a long walk. The scene you referred to earlier with Bashir and O'Brien is a like replimat scene, and O'Brien is a little bit just trying to get Bashir to like comment on what he's looking at, you know? Like he's got the iPad with the design for the arboretum that he's going to build for Keiko. He's looking at Bashir kind of like holding it out so that it's like impossible for Bashir not to say something about it. But Bashir winds up having actual relationship wisdom here.
I understand why you want to continue the positive character building with Bashir by giving him a scene like this, but I've got a rewrite for this episode, and that is switching these scenes between Bashir and Sisko and what happens in them, because I think it makes far more sense for this advice to be coming from Sisko and far more sense for Bashir to have had some sort of unused lab on the station that he wasn't really doing medical science in,
right,
to offer to O'Brien as a place for her to do that work. Contextually, this makes no sense that Bashir has this kind of advice. Like, his entire character up until now has been one of not grasping even the basic idea of how to treat a woman or be in a relationship. So, I mean, it's good advice ultimately, and it actually is the thing that triggers action for O'Brien. But I really wish that they put these words in someone else's mouth.
Yeah, because it's like the core of the problem is that Keiko is a capable, ambitious woman, and there's like no obvious place for her to focus her energy anymore. And, you know, an arboretum is not going to scratch the itch is basically what Bashir is saying. It's going to turn her career into a diversion, not the thing that she's actually like achieving things with.
Bashir says you can't be happy turning your career into a hobby.
Yeah.
It made me think a lot about how we have turned our hobby into a career.
Yeah.
And how ultimately satisfying that is.
Yeah.
Compared to the reverse.
I agree.
Quark finds out that House DeGore has systematically ruined the finances of House Kozak.
Quark is really it's really DeGore's worst nightmare. Like,
he is.
Like, if DeGore is a Patak that uses money to achieve his goals, like, Quark is a fucking beast in that department. He is a certified Patak with a lot of financial savvy.
DeGore's no dummy, though, because he's got Rom in his back pocket, because he's sort of predicted Quark's financial abilities here and is like, I've got like a parry to this financial thrust. and producing Rom here is really effective.
Hello, brother.
And Rom is there to like discredit Quark's story, you know, which originally DeGore needed the story to be that it was an honorable death, but now he's going to try and undercut it, and Rom is the only other witness to the death to throw some doubt on Quark's narrative.
Right.
And it turns into we're going to have to Bat'leth it out.
Yeah, it's Bat'leth's a done, right?
Yeah. And Quark has a pretty savvy strategy here, which is toss the Bat'leth and say,
go ahead, kill me.
You'd be a real asshole to do it because I'm unarmed, and I know, like, even if I was armed, it would be a totally lopsided fight. Like what are you proving by chopping my head off with a Bat'leth?
I really love how this unconventional strategy by him seems true to what we know that he knows.
Yeah.
Like, he's not an expert in Klingon politics, but everything that he's picked up on in this episode leads to this point in a way that makes sense.
Right. Like, he every time he acted with some confidence in thinking he knew how a Klingon was going to react to something, it's been wrong until this moment.
Yeah.
But you've actually seen him like learn the hard way each time. And this actually like makes sense that he would try this gambit here.
Yeah.
And it works. Like, DeGore is like getting ready to swing on him, and Gowron like knocks him over basically. He's like, what the fuck is wrong with you, you dope?
You have no honor.
Give me a fucking break. And they do the discommendation thing.
Yeah.
They do the cross the arms and turn the backs on him.
It's a real like Wakandan salute situation.
Am I doing the salute wrong? I think it's the fact you're doing it.
Yeah, they invented the Wakandan salute on Kronos, of all places.
That means Black Panther is canonical Trek.
I love that about Black Panther.
Well, having dispensed his ruling, that only leaves the Quark and Grilka marriage to be dealt with. And you're only ever a slap and spit away from a divorce if you're in a Klingon marriage, Ben. If that were the case here, we would have been divorced thousands of times. You and I wouldn't be in business anymore because that's how you dissolve a business also.
Sure is.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
Evening, everybody.
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
Yeah, the button on the episode is that the bar is back to not being in great shape, but is holding on with it by its fingernails. And O'Brien and Keiko are up on the second level having a quiet drink together. And O'Brien's like, hey, listen, I might have a solution to this career issue that you're dealing with. I found out about this expedition that's going to some like remote part of Bajor for 6 months to... And they need a botanist. Like, they need somebody with your skill set. Weirdly also has figured out a way for Molly to go with her. Like, he's like, I'm not going to take any responsibility for our child. You take her on this challenging trip into rugged terrain that has never been charted before. Like, keep the kid on the station, O'Brien, you dope.
Three-year-olds love camping, and parents love camping with them. Give me a fucking break. This is not a good idea, Chief.
Not a great idea. Like, I understand that she would feel terrible not being with her three-year-old child for 6 months, but like, it's also established that it's, while it is a remote part of Bajor, it's only a three-hour trip by runabout, and O'Brien can get one whenever he wants. So put the kid in the runabout every weekend and head to Bajor.
Did you get the sense that at the end of this scene that she would apply? It felt a little bit ambiguous.
Yeah, I don't think that they committed to it, but...
What isn't ambiguous is, like, he has empowered her and motivated her towards, like, chasing her career aspirations, and that's good. Like, that's good enough. That's a satisfying resolution to their story in this episode.
Because she feels chained to this agreement that they made, that they were going to move here and do this for a while.
It's fucking sad when she says that over and over again, like, she's clearly upset by this decision. She feels like obligated and pot committed at this point. Like, her, Rosalind Chow's performance in this scene is really great, and it's kind of heartbreaking.
It is.
Downstairs in Quark's bar, we have a moment between Rom and Quark that feel almost the same way. Like they've become closer as a result of this adventure.
Yeah, Rom is really licking Quark's asshole in this scene.
Kind of touching. He just wants to hear the bedtime story about Quark killing a Klingon.
Yeah. I love that that's what Rom wants. Tell me that, like, semi-fictional version of the thing that we all just lived through again.
Rom is totally the Lenny to this George, to Quark's George in this situation, right? Rom is petting the latinum.
Yeah.
Did you like this episode?
I did. I thought it was a really good episode. It was fun to see them kind of build on a lot of like established canon, the way like Klingon politics works and how discommendation works and stuff. All of that was really fun to see. I like that Keiko is not like, she's not a main cast character, but they're also not going to just leave her in a kind of like established role and like never think about like what she would want as a person ever again. Like, the fact that the writers are thinking about like, what does this mean for somebody like Keiko, and then telling an interesting story about that is like a real step forward. How about you?
I really like the episode too. And if you were to just tell me what the ingredients were without a plot, I wouldn't say that I would be super thrilled about it.
Right.
Like, in assembling these ingredients and creating this story, I think what you have here is really great. I really like Grilka a lot. Like, Grilka as a character is, like, I think one of my favorite characters that we've run into on Deep Space Nine. It's a great episode for Armin Shimmerman, too. The actor who plays Grilka is Mary Kay Adams. And I went looking at her career a little bit, and what I came across was some interesting trivia actually having to do with Mary Chifo, who plays Laurel on Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, yeah?
And Mary Chifo said that Grilka was her favorite Klingon character.
Wow.
I really loved in Deep Space Nine Grilka. I loved her story with Quark and how she ended up having to work the system and become the leader of her own house, which was, in a patriarchal species, so unique and thrilling. because she plays the Rel as a full Klingon, she used Grilka as kind of a jumping off point in how to play that character. And I think in thinking about Lorel, like, you can see some Grilka in her.
Definitely.
In that performance. And I think that's really cool.
Good find.
Yeah, not all research is bad. You know what's never bad, Ben?
What?
Is the ceremonial reading of Priority One messages. That's where you slap me and then spit at my face. And then we read a message and then I slap you, spit in your face. And then we read the second one.
Mm-hmm. We usually cut the slapping and spitting part out just because it's kind of gross on microphone.
But... Right. Yeah.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first Priority One message is of a personal nature. It is from Aneth. It is for Jen. The message goes like this. My dearest Jen, thank you for an amazing first year of marriage. I am so lucky to have found the perfect kitty mama, traveling companion, dance partner, theater buddy, and best friend. Coming home to you every day is a gift. Here's to the decades to come and to our continuing adventures as a family. Love always, Aneth.
Is Aneth a cat?
I don't believe cats have opposable thumbs.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And those are a requirement for completing a Priority One message form.
Fair enough. Wow, what a lovely message.
Yeah, that's real nice.
First year's a big year.
I mean, any moment now, they're going to be like confiding weaknesses in each other.
And... Oh, yeah. Vulnerability is just around the corner for you, too. I can just tell.
That's a big part in any marriage.
Yeah.
I know you'll do great.
Adam, our second Priority One message is from Dennis from Minneapolis, and it's for Ben and Adam. It goes like this. I'm 6 months behind on the pod and too lazy to look online, so apologies to my fellow viewers if this has already been covered. If you could have any TNG or DS9 loaf, what would they be and why? Important note, you don't become the alien in question. You just, like, get their loaf, man. Thanks for a life-changing show. You two are the absolute best. Ah, thanks,
wow.
Dennis.
Wow.
Man, that's a great question. What loaf?
I love it when people ask us questions. Loaf, huh?
Yeah.
Loaf, but loaf without the alien. Huh. You know what? So much loaf out there seems difficult to clean.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, I feel like you're going to want to go in there with a Q-tip.
Lots of nooks and crannies in some of that loaf.
So I'm inclined to choose less loaf versus more. Are you a more loaf person?
Does Data count as loaf? Because I think I would be Data. I would look like Data if I was going to look like a character.
I don't think that counts.
Yeah, it's got to be. It's got to have, like, dimension to it, right? It can't just be face paint. The easiest one would be Bajoran, right? Just get a little nose ridge, you know? A little bendy straw on the nose.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most comfortable to sleep in, I think.
You'd probably get a lot of high fives if you had Vulcan loaf.
I think my choice is going to be the alien from The Most Toys with that rhythmic gymnastics ribbon stuck in his face.
It goes, like, all throughout.
Because that seems like something that's removable, right? Like, that's almost a removable piercing of loaf.
Yeah, that's like jewelry in his loaf.
And I gotta say, like, I don't know whether this is, like, a good way to answer the question, but I think a lot about how I would sleep with that kind of loaf. I think if you become the alien, sleep would come easy to you because you're used to it. But if I'm just a human wearing loaf, I think that sounds like a nightmare. And so I'd want at least semi-removable loaf in that case. And so that's why I'm picking rhythmic gymnastics loaf.
Yeah, like, I think we all know that Cardassian would be the worst loaf.
Yeah.
Because like, we saw people walking around as Cardassians at Star Trek Las Vegas. That just looked very uncomfortable.
If you're doing Cardassian play, I think you should win the contest. That seems like the hardest kind.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of adhesive.
A lot of adhesive. A lot of intricate little bits that have to go in, you know, under your nose, but above your upper lip and stuff. Rough. Rough stuff.
Wonder if they're giving out dirty sheets at Star Trek conventions when you check into that hotel. We'll never know.
Yeah.
Well, if you have a Priority One message, and especially if you have a question for Ben or I that we could answer on the show, you can take it on over to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages and questions are $100 and commercial messages for your great idea or business are $200. They are a great way to spread the word far and wide about what your interests are and help support the greatest generation.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, my Shimoda's a scene Shimoda, Ben, and it's the one that you referred to earlier. The scene where Quark has Gowron and everyone else in the chambers clicking through their TI-82s, following along,
yeah,
like with the accounting report that he's presenting. Like, there is physical comedy happening there that is... All it is a calculator in a Klingon's hand. And, like, that is hilarious.
Yeah.
I love that
that's
scene.
That's an earned laugh. Like, they've earned that over years and years of television.
Like, that's all you need to see to get a kick out of it. I love that scene. And that was, like, the most absurd moment in the episode. That felt like, that's like Shimoda on the floor.
Yeah,
to me, that was great.
I mean, Gowron in that scene was my Shimoda, just like for flipping the.
Yeah,
you know, he literally like throws it away at some point. He's like, I don't fucking care. I don't care about any of this crap. I loved that.
Great Shimodas.
Yeah, I think that counts as a daily double, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, they're in the same scene.
Yeah.
Gotta get that gold press ladder. Get that
gold press ladder.
Am I right?
Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. Every mom I have ever given an Aura frame to has absolutely loved it. And that includes a lot of moms I know. This is a gift that I have personally given many, many times, and it's great. I can upload photos from my phone the moment I take them. And that means that mom or grandma out there is going to get pictures of their loved ones delivered to their living room. And right now, Aura is having a great sale for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com and use the code SCARVS at checkout to show your support for our show. Terms and conditions apply. Mother's Day is coming up, and one of the best gifts you can give a mom that you might share a bed with is doing some yard work. Some yard work downstairs, if you know what I mean. With Manscaped, this season, make sure you groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants to let the mother of your children know how much you appreciate her continuing to put up with you.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
What do we have coming up in the next episode?
The next episode is Season 3, Episode 4, Equilibrium. While experimenting with a keyboard, the musically untrained Dex inexplicably plays a melody she seems to remember from somewhere.
That seems like a joke.
That's the actual description they have on Netflix. Of course, Amazon went with, a deadly secret from Dax's past could mean the end of Jadzia's life.
Oh, that sounds like a better episode.
Yeah. Stakes officially raised.
Wow.
So big Dax episode coming up next week, in which either we spent a lot of time finding out how she learned to play keyboard, or something threatens her life.
Very exciting. Well, speaking of excitement, we are on square 94 of the Game of Buttholes.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
We're in some danger here, I would say, because four squares away, we've got a butthole that goes down to an nth degree.
We sure do.
And six squares away, we've got a Morn Hammered episode.
Of course, Morn Hammered is the Power Hour episode, which I think we both fear and respect.
Perfectly put, Ben. Why don't you roll that bone?
Oh shit, dog. We have landed square on square 100.
Really?
Really?
Well, for all those who have been lamenting the amount of Quark's Bar episodes in this run of
Have you heard
of
much of that? I feel like we have lamented it.
I mean, this is why I shouldn't lurk on our Facebook or our Reddit pages.
Well, doing a Morn Hammered episode is a great way. We're going to recycle. We're going to go back to one after that, right? And
okay.
We'll have some new squares on the board, and maybe a few fewer Quark's Bars.
I like that. As a result. I was just going to ask what we were doing after this. So that sounds satisfying to me.
Right on.
It would be weird if we got separate runabouts and we each had to roll. And like one of us is doing a Quark's Bar and one of us is doing a Naked Now.
Jesus.
I don't want to do that.
No, that's a terrible idea, Adam. Why did you even say it out loud?
One of us is doing a Looking at Each Other During and one of them is doing a Naked Now. We must take great care in making sure that never happens.
Yeah. Mutually assured destruction. Well, that will be the next episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine. In the meantime,
it's a big one.
We need your support to make this show. This show takes a lot of work to do every week, and you can support it in many ways. You can go to MaximumFun.org/donate. If you do that, you get access to lots of great bonus content. We're always adding bonus content. We're really proud of the special donors-only episodes that are in that feed. We also really appreciate people who leave nice ratings and reviews on their podcast software, recommending the show to people online, and recommending it to friends in real life is also a great way to get the word out there.
We also appreciate people who flag one-star reviews as inappropriate wherever reviews are given. That also gives us a great big help.
Yeah, we love that shit. Here's the hashtag GreatestGen on Twitter, where Adam is at CutForTime and I'm at Benjamin R.
Maybe not for long, though.
We also have a Facebook group, or so I'm told, and a Reddit sub.
Yeah, those places will live on even if we're not there.
Yeah, great communities.
Go meet a special person. We had a proposal happen at one of our live shows that I believe were two people who met in that fan community. So
yeah, that was really cool.
Pretty awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, we got to do a priority one message proposal, and what a treat. We got to thank Adam Ragusea, who makes all the custom music for the show. Of course, Dark Materia, who made the original theme song. And our card daddy, Bill Tilly, who makes trading cards of every episode, and he puts them up on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, and that guy's the best.
One of the main reasons to stay on Sochmead.
Yeah, no kidding. If I left Twitter, I'd never see the Card Daddy. Can't do that. Private Twitter.
Yeah.
Just me and Card Daddy.
Yeah, you could just unfollow everybody but Bill Tilly. I'd support that.
Yeah, I'll think about that. Well, with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which drunkenly plays chopsticks until we're kicked out of the bar.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.